Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we get the pleasure of talking with Dr. Brian Scheitman and Dr. Bayat Steiner, Medical Director and Associate Medical Director of the Wake Brook Recovery Center, as well as clinical professors at UNC, about combining mental health and primary care.
Yeah, this integration, so to speak, of kind of behavioral care, mental health care, primary care is the wave of the future, but it's actually happening now, and we get to speak with some of the regional experts on this who are doing it. I'm very excited about this.
They are paving the way. I'm looking forward to
that. But first, we've got some research that matters about making decisions in the intensive care unit, and as a caretaker, could this be linked to post-traumatic stress disorder?
About damage to DNA and cells seen in patients undergoing CT scanning.
About participating in extracurricular sports when you're a young kindergartner, and is that linked to important outcomes that are beneficial as the child gets older?
And about magnetic pulses easing ringing in the ears for people who have that thing called tinnitus or tinnitus. It's hard to know how to say it, but it's ringing in the ears.
That's easier to say.
That is much easier to say. Let's talk about this decision-making in the ICU for families and how that relates to post-traumatic stress disorder.
You know, Christy, this research that was in the journal Critical Care Medicine really speaks to me because I remember when my father was ill of blessed memory many, many years ago in an intensive care unit and needing to make decisions that were really life and death decisions about his health care. And the struggles that I really had for many years later thinking, did I do the right thing? Did I make the right decisions? And here this research is asking and looking at those very questions.
And they found that there is, you know, a significant emotional role for the decision maker, especially if they're having to make these life or death decisions and don't have all the information and don't have, there's a lot of pressure to make the right decisions and then to kind of deal with a fallout, especially if someone passes away. And they found that there were three different coping styles for family decision makers: emotional, problem solving, and what's called avoidance coping.
And when they looked at whether those different coping styles were related to kind of the outcomes of whether people suffered, in this case, post-traumatic stress disorder, it didn't really seem to have much impact. But probably more importantly is that 42% of the family decision makers did have, within several months, some clinically significant symptoms of distress. And I really can understand this because you really do struggle. Are you making the right decision? And I ultimately kept reassuring myself I made the right decision. And I did. And that's how I think most family members really do need to understand this. And, you know, I don't think that I did avoidance coping, but I certainly kind of use the emotional and problem solving skills. People can use all three at times.
Sure. But that avoidance coping was where you're avoiding the situation was associated with higher risks of that post-traumatic stress disorder. And so it raises some questions of as family members to make sure we're thinking about how we're coping and supporting each other and asking questions, expressing oneself. And then also as providers and family members, thinking about making sure you're caring for each other, getting counseling, getting therapy to kind of work through some of those things after the event has happened and certainly after a loved one has passed.
Let's talk about our next research that matters, Christy. And this is, I think, an equally important study because of what's happening around the world and in the United States and our practices about kind of an explosion of CAT scans. Diagnostically, we can diagnose more, we can see more than ever before.
And, you know, people like getting still, even though we talk about radiation and risks of radiation, a lot of people just feel more comfort if they've gotten scanned because they feel like doctors would have picked up on more things. And there's been a lot of movement towards getting more of these CAT scans related to heart disease and cardiologists really assessing how people's hearts are doing related to these CAT scans.
And we're continuously trying to lower the radiation dose. We have low dose, so to speak, CAT scans now, screening CAT scans for lung cancer even. And this particular research really looks at, is there actual DNA damage, damage to the matrix of the cells that are responsible for us living healthy?
And this study was published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, and they really looked at the use of medical imaging for heart disease with this, you know, small amount of low-dose radiation in the CAT scans, and found that, in fact, there was cellular damage or damage to the cells associated with getting these CAT scans.
Yeah, this was on 67 patients who had undergone cardiac CT angiograms. And they were looking at, in the bloodstream, luckily they didn't do CT scans to detect this, but in the bloodstream, looking at the sequence of the genes, how things panned out when they did assays measuring biomarkers of DNA damage before and after the procedure.
Yeah, and they did find that there were changes associated with having these CAT scans done. So, I mean,
and there was repair. But oftentimes, particularly if a person was less well, the repair didn't happen fully. And so the question is, could repeated CAT scans cause cumulative cell death? And the National Cancer Institute has even estimated that, you know, up to 29,000 future cancer cases could be attributed to the CT scans, the 72 million that are done every year in the United States. I think this is something we need to talk more about. We don't want to scare people away from having necessary CAT scans, but always asking the question, is it necessary? Is a great question.
It absolutely is. Raise the question, and we need to understand this more fully. The next question is, if you put your kids in sports in kindergarten, are there any differences in how they do in school or in their other behaviors when they're older?
And one of the things that I think a lot of parents perhaps have questions about is when to put your kids into structured sports, things like soccer or things like cheerleading, like my daughter was doing it. What age is the right age? Because you're right, it could be stressful for all kinds of reasons.
Well, it's stressful because in our community, there's just a lot of pressure to get your kids into things so early and try to train everyone to be Olympians at age 5. And the children a lot of times aren't, you know, have a hard time understanding the rules of the game. But at the same time, it may be teaching them some important values and some important social skills that make it worth the pain.
And this was a study in the American Journal of Health Promotion following 2,700 children from Quebec who were born 1997, 1998, and they followed them out for a number of years. And they looked then, asking about the parents and their home life, and followed them out for 4 years and asked the parents again and the teachers about, does participation in, like, extracurricular sports, not necessarily competitive, you know, rock science, you know, playing tennis, but these group team sports, does it predict when they're playing it when they're young how their self-discipline will be in fourth grade? And does that predict that they're going to continue to play in sports? Because these would be good things if that were true.
Yeah, absolutely. And they did find that children who were involved in sports when they were in kindergarten were likely to be involved in team sports at age 10, and that those kids also had higher self-control scores by fourth grade than kids who hadn't been involved in team sports.
And this didn't translate into success in the classroom, but there was an association, whether it's cause and effect, but it does suggest that this is something for, I think, parents to consider. As you know, we were joking before the show, Christy, about, you know, the book about, you know, the super mom, the super dad who want everything for their kids. There's something about maybe these group extracurricular activities that really teaches things that you can't learn just from alone from reading the book or, you know, these kind of individual sorts of experiences.
Right. Agreed. Okay. Let's talk about something a little different, also about the brain, but this is about magnetic pulses to the brain for people who have ringing or phantom sounds in their ears.
This was in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal called Otolaryngology, ENT is what we sometimes say, head and neck surgery. And this Question of this tinnitus or tinnitus, this ringing in the ears, which is really a problematic issue for so many people. And we've done a show on this or talked about it before. And this is, I think, some hope that I'm really happy that we can report about this potential for transcranial magnetic stimulation.
Yeah, we've talked about that on the show before. This is a
study. For depression.
Yeah, exactly. And it showed some promise, some significant promise. And this is a study of 64 people who had this ringing in their ears. And they found that over 10 consecutive business days of treatments that lasted about 35 minutes each, that the people who got the real TMS compared with people who got sort of fake or sham magnetic stimulation, that the people who got the real thing had more improvement of their ear ringing, and that lasted 6 months compared with, I mean, at 6 months, they still were much improved compared with the group who got the fake stimulation.
Yeah, the fake stimulation worked a third of the time, though. That was kind of, oops, we don't, you know. It suggests that there's more to this than meets the ear.
Oh, nice.
But that I think that'll conclude the research that matters. I think these are interesting, important, and potentially things that people can use. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Brian Scheitman and Dr. Bayat Steiner, professors at the University of North Carolina, about combining mental health and primary care. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Brian Scheitman and Dr. Bayat Steiner, Medical Director and Associate Medical Director of the Wakebrook Recovery Center, as well as clinical professors at the University of North Carolina, about combining mental health and primary care.
Welcome, Dr. Scheitman and Dr. Steiner.
Nice to be here.
Great to be here.
We're glad to have you. And I'd love, by way of introduction, Dr. Scheitman, you are a psychiatrist and Dr. Steiner, a family physician. But describe for us why you chose to focus and incorporate an emphasis in mental health in your careers.
I always was just fascinated by human behavior. You know, when I first got to medical school, I would look at the cadaver, and it wasn't quite as interesting to me as looking at the people around the cadaver. And I really said to myself, maybe that's the field that I should go into. And then I would look at all the journals, and I'd always gravitate to the behavioral health journals. So I was really fascinated by human behavior, and that really has continued. So that's kind of how I segued into it.
When you say the people around the cadaver.
Well, like all the medical students.
When the medical students were going, ooh, they were so excited, and you were excited about the fact that they were excited, or if they were like getting kind of grossed out, you'd be like, huh, what's that reaction about?
Well, it was like 8 different students, and you'd see 8 different reactions, and then each of the students would interact with the other student in sort of a different way, and I was just really just amazed at all those different reactions, and I think maybe that's the field I should go into.
Maybe that's a new screening test for to see if you want to go into psychiatry. I love it. What about you, Dr. Steiner?
So, you know, family medicine has been the specialty that's been really fulfilling for me all my life, and I think the important thing there is to take care of patients across the spectrum, you know, young kids, older people. But I think what really drew me to mental health, the other passion for me, is taking care of underserved patients, patients who don't have good access. And it's been just really powerful to see how little access patients with serious mental illness have. And I think that's been sort of the most rewarding part of going to Wakebrook.
What do you mean by the patients with serious mental health issues don't have access? What do you mean? And can you give an example from maybe your experience?
Yeah, so Brian may be able to chime in a little bit also, but it's been my sense that if you have serious mental illness, so partly insurance may not cover you as well, but also just the way your life is organized, it's harder to take care of all the conditions that may need the attention of a family physician.
And I think the field of medicine in general is really changing in that providers are being stretched. They have to see a lot more people. Everybody needs to stick to their time limits. And when you're working with people with serious mental illness, that's a little bit harder. There's more challenges. Sometimes people won't show up on time. They may be on more medications. There may be other family issues. There's more likely that they have added problems. So to sort of pigeonhole people into a 10-minute slot is off. It just doesn't work. And I think people, the people with serious mental illness feel that, and they just sort of gravitate away from healthcare, and the ramifications have been really serious.
Well, there are also a lot of steps that go into making a doctor's appointment, getting transportation, getting a medical record number. I mean, all these things, showing ID, signing forms, reading things, all kinds of things that can be barriers if a person is suffering from a mental illness or not, really.
Well, and I'll tell you one more thing. So I work at Prospect Hill Community Health Center, which is a federally qualified health center taking care of underserved patients. And I saw many of the same patients I now see at Wakebrook. But one of the bigger problems, so they were trying to be very accommodating for some of the things you just mentioned, but having good key to this. And at Prospect Hill, I would oftentimes not quite be sure who the psychiatrist is, or it'd be difficult to get in touch with that person. And here at Wakebrook, we really just take care of these patients side by side. And I think that may be the biggest innovation of what we're doing at Wakebrook.
So we're going to talk a lot about what you're doing at Wakebrook, how mental health and primary care services are being connected in maybe a couple different models. But I wonder if we could just talk for a second about, we know that access to a primary care physician can be difficult for a lot of people to find that person who's willing to take responsibility. Dr. Scheidtman, what do we know about psychiatry and access to psychiatrists? I know, for instance, in my own practice, finding access to child psychiatrists is sometimes, for me, very difficult for my patients. What about adults?
I think it's also a challenge. Many people with serious mental illness will not have private insurance. They have public insurance. So there's certain pathways they have to go to. And oftentimes, again, this issue of logistics where people may not show up for their appointment because they don't have transportation, they can't get there. Their next appointment will be at 3 months. So a lot. It's a great challenge to meet the needs of the people with serious mental illness. So I hear child psychiatry, I hear sometimes more the word impossible is used, that it's just...
And frustrating if you're a patient or a provider.
Well, my wife's a pediatric neurologist, so I hear it all the time firsthand, that she's, what's going on? I can't get this child an appointment. The child comes in, it looks like they're having really acute problems, and it takes forever to get an appointment. So I'm very aware of the problems of access to psychiatry.
Okay, without further ado, we're talking to Dr. Scheidtman as the Associate Medical Director and Dr. Steiner as the Medical Director of Wakebrook, and would love for you to tell us, what is it we're talking about? What exactly is this model, and how is it different from other mental health facilities across the nation?
So the one thing that some of your listeners may have heard of is when you have psychiatrists working in family medicine offices. And I think that's become more and more of an accepted model. Sometimes it's called co-location. And I think that's been a very effective way to get patients seen in primary care and also get mental health care needs. I think we're taking care of a different patient population, patients with very serious mental illness who really probably need a psychiatrist more than they need a family doctor. So that's who they see on a more regular basis. But then what ends up happening, they lose the care that a family medicine doctor provides. They may not be taking care of their high blood pressure or their diabetes. And so I think the innovation is that we as family physicians have gone to the psychiatric setting and are providing family medicine care in the psychiatric setting.
Now, the focus here is on serious mental illness.
So like what?
And serious mental illness, and that's a good question, people with typically psychotic disorders, people with severe bipolar disorders, many people who, even with treatment, lots of people will have great levels of recovery, but some people, maybe 20% of people with those illnesses don't. So the people who are still maybe somewhat symptomatic, and often those are the people who sort of have more trouble going into the typical sort of private office. But this primary care office is designated just for those types of people. So that's how we set everything up. That's the expectation. So our staff knows that that's who's going to be here. And I think, you know, after a while, you get to know those folks and really love them. But in this case, they're actually the majority, not the minority.
And so how does that differ, let's say, from some of the models from a decade ago where we had these institutional outpatient hospitals, almost residential facilities for people with serious mental health, and they would go live there for 1, 2, 3 months? Is that different than this model?
Well, in those days, this model, the primary care office is really all outpatient. People come and have scheduled visits. We try to have them see the same person time and again, but they don't actually live there. So this is different in this sense that they would be going like any other primary care office. The office just happens to be in a behavioral health setting. So it's different than the way it used to be.
And how about the difference of having the psychiatrist or behavior person come to the office of the primary care? Like in our family medicine center, we have a psychiatrist and behavioralist who come versus moving the primary care doctor to the psychiatrist.
I think that's where the difference in the mental illness makes a difference. So the patient maybe with depression or struggling with anxiety is very well suited to be taken care of in the family medicine office. The person that Brian described oftentimes needs the support, the staff, the setting that can support patients with more significant mental illnesses. And I think that's what we're able to provide, that sort of more holistic setting where patients with severe mental illness feel comfortable.
Great. We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guests, Dr. Brian Scheitman and Dr. Bayat Steiner, medical directors of Wake Brook Recovery Center, as well as clinical professors at the University of North Carolina, about combining mental health and primary care. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Brian Scheitman and Dr. Bayat Steiner, the directors of Wake Brook Recovery Center, as well as clinical professors at the University of North Carolina, about combining mental health in primary care. And right before the break, we really started talking about the kind of benefits in these different environments. And I can tell you, I am like a convert here. I am such a believer, because now that we have access to psychiatrists in our practice, I see how critically important patients are improving, because this co-management and the sharing, and you run into the psychiatrist, you can have the conversation, the patients are happy. Help us understand, because you're taking care of much sicker patients with mental health. Tell us maybe the types of real situations you're dealing with and the problems that they have.
So maybe by giving you an example would be helpful. So I have a patient that I saw just a little while ago, has pretty bad schizophrenia. And there are many family medicine offices in Raleigh, but this man has never found his way to a family medicine office. He's been in the emergency room 30 times over the past year for a number of fairly minor complaints, not for ill intentions, but because of his disorganized life, that's the only place he could find himself to. He was connected to our practice because the psychiatrist who takes care of him is part of our referral network. Since then, I saw him first time about a month ago. He's seen me twice, and he's not been back to the emergency room, and really feels cared for. And I don't think the family medicine office, which is the perfect setting for the large majority of Americans to have a patient-centered medical home, but I think for the subset, smaller subsets of patients, they need a different environment that cares for them in a different way, I think.
And so from that sense, keeping this man out of the emergency department for the less emergency needs and getting him a primary care home is a really key outcome. But as you're looking to move this forward for the subset, how do you measure your success and benefits of mental health and benefits of healthcare outcomes? What are your goals?
So here's my passion. So I think because on average, this patient population lives 25 years less. So a patient with serious mental illness lives 25 years less long than an average American.
Shocking.
It's shocking. And I think we can't be satisfied till those outcomes are more similar. There's really not much reason that these outcomes shouldn't be more similar. most of the reasons they die, the majority, are not for psychiatric reasons. Therefore, the more common things like dying from smoking, dying from cancer.
Because they smoke at very high rates compared to folks who don't have this.
Right. For some reason, we're not really sure why, but it may be something, some part of the illness that people with serious mental illness smoke at much higher rates. There's lots of hypotheses. Maybe it's the medications they're on. But if you look at the evidence, even before people have ever received any medication, the rates of cigarette smoking are higher. So there might be some other factor, and it might be more challenging. But nevertheless, it's really an important goal to work on to reduce smoking. You never even expose people to this. So it's in everything, I think that with people with serious mental illness have a little bit of a greater challenge, but the 25-year difference is just outrageous. And I think it speaks to the fact that people are just not seeking out primary care, those people with serious mental illness.
And part of that, you mentioned the cancer rates. Part of that must be certainly tied to the smoking, but also if they're not getting their preventive screenings, their colonoscopy, pap smear, breast mammography, whatever, that they may get undiagnosed or have later diagnosis for cancer.
And I think we've been too easily satisfied saying, all right, you know, let's make sure they get psychiatric needs met, but then not worry so much about the other conditions, which in truth are probably less urgent. When you're having delusions, to take care of your diabetes may seem at the moment less urgent. But I think we just can't be satisfied till we take care of both the physical health and mental health and do it together.
So it appears to me that there's still a tremendous stigmatization and marginalization of people with the types of mental health conditions that you're treating. Help us understand, Dr. Scheitman, how does maybe these new models begin to help all of us face this?
Well, I think there's some issues of stigma and access. So I think if you don't receive treatment, you don't get treatment, it's not likely that treatment's going to work. So I think beginning to sort of see that the new norm is that everybody should get similar care and may have to be modified some for different people. But just assuming that these people, because they were sick, they don't understand is really just not true. Plus, there's a lot of evidence now that people with serious mental illness, lots of them reach high levels of recovery. So most folks do much better than we used to think. This notion of a steady progressive deterioration is really not found to have been true at all. So, and actually, as people get older, they actually their psychiatric conditions actually improve. So there's really, I think, a tremendous opportunity to really make a difference, but it's going to take some active energy. And I think some people have been turned off a little bit by the whole sort of physical health world, so we may have to sort of do a little bit of an adjustment.
And what about as people age? Do you see any older and geriatric patients? Because I would think that they're out there. This is not like something. Some of them are living longer because of your work. How does that change what you do?
Well, I think they have the same sort of increased medical problems as people age that everyone else does. And what you're saying about mental health, there was a lot of studies that have this original study was done at the State Hospital of Vermont, and people followed these people for 30 years after they were seen and thought to be people who could not be helped. And actually, 30 years later, many of them were out of the hospital, doing fairly well, and not quite as sick as people thought. And people originally, that was just an aberration. But that's been replicated many, many times. So we do see people with a geriatric population who have had serious mental illnesses. They're out there. Their condition actually gets better, and they may be more responsive to care than we originally thought.
I want to go back to something you had said earlier about the models of care may be different. And just a quick example of a patient. I think when we have these very quick visits, which we are oftentimes forced to do 10 minutes in outpatient family medicine offices, when your thinking is a little bit different, you may need more time. This patient, talking about prevention, was very hesitant to get a flu shot. And I had talked to him several times, and he didn't really want to, and we had enough time, and I finally asked him, what would it take for you to get a flu shot? And he wanted a cup of coffee. So just, you know, our nurse was able to get him a cup of coffee, and he needed that time to have a cup of coffee and reflect. And that was so beautiful to work in a setting that was less pressured. He was able to get his preventive services needs met. The patient experience was great. And it would not happen if we'd only had 10 minutes to rush through a visit.
Wow. It wasn't the population attributable risk and the epidemiology and all the scientific discussions and those informed decision aids.
A cup of coffee.
Right. Wow.
Or a cup of coffee. Could this work for colon cancer screening?
Yeah. Well, you think about, you've mentioned the difference in life expectancy for this population and maybe the need for more time and patience and coordinated care. What else have you learned? I mean, we know that the mental health system, if you call it a system, is broken, and you're really making some headway of trying to figure out a new model. What else have you learned that can really help us move forward with policymakers and in trying to affect change?
I think a lot of these people are really no different than anyone else. I mean, I think that's the biggest thing, and sometimes there's a sort of stigma, but I had an arthroscopic shoulder surgery, and after my shoulder surgery, people called me in 1 week about four different times trying to find out how my shoulder was. And I said, my shoulder's fine, I'm fine. But yet, we don't do the same thing in mental health, and I'm flabbergasted, why not? Like, why don't we, when we discharge people to get, I argue this all the time, why aren't we calling these people and seeing how they're doing? Why aren't we sending someone out to the house to see how they're doing if need be? And that doesn't happen, and so trying to get this thing organized, I don't think it's really impossible, but it just seems like the will to do it. And why we treat physical health and mental health so different is just amazing to me. I don't get it.
One quick final question, Dr. Steiner. What's the vision for how we actually can pay for this type of care?
Adam, I think we need a different mechanism to pay for care. In the fee-for-service world, you get paid per visit. If we really want to change care, we have to figure out how we get paid to meet the quality outcomes, to make sure that the patients are satisfied, but not do it under time pressure and do it in a more creative way where we can work together with social workers, with nurses, in a bigger team, and really care for the patient and not worry so much about each bill for each visit.
And combining physical and mental health together.
All right. Thank you so much. Great vision.
Leading the way, you both are. We've been talking with Dr. Brian Scheidman and Dr. Bayat Steiner, Medical Director and Associate Medical Director of the Wake Brook Recovery Center, as well as clinical professors at UNC. We're talking about combining mental health and primary care. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about the questions you've sent us and your concerns.
And you can send us your own questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we have some good house calls today about people worried about getting an infection for their newborn baby from their dog,
about earwax, and about drinking.
And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first house call question.
I had a baby a few months ago. I also have a very friendly dog who is rapidly becoming best friends with our baby. Should I be worried about the dog getting our baby sick? He gets a bath every week or two, and he doesn't drink from the toilet or anything, but he's still a dog, and dogs get dirty. Should I be keeping a closer eye on things?
Well, you know, Christy, this is very near and dear to me. In some respects, I have a puppy, and that puppy loves little children. I mean, you know, the adults, oh, you're pretty cool, but little children, oh, my God, these are great, 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 and just goes and hangs out around the kids.
Yeah, and I think it's a wonderful thing for children and to be raised around animals and to have that extra kind of affection from our pets. But the question of risk to the baby, you know, I would be less worried about the baby getting sick from the dog, although, you know, the dog could have fleas or other things that could bite the baby potentially and cause a rash or some itchy bumps. But to be mindful, depending on the size of your dog and the risk for a bite. Sometimes dogs, especially as the baby gets a little older and can play and pull a tail, a dog might get confused and potentially bite the child.
Yeah, and I'm less worried about, you know, the dogs necessarily getting dirty because the little babies...
They get dirty, too.
get dirty, have, you know, kind of poop and everything. And, you know, but I do think there's that element that you mentioned, Christy. And also the licking and the dog's saliva has things that aren't necessarily you would necessarily always want to be exposed to on either open skin or, you know, directly in the mouth. So I do think paying attention and maybe not having unsupervised t- time. We got to have play time and play visits.
Supervise play
there,
time.
Yeah, and teach the dog also to be very socialized around the baby because the dogs really need to be gentle and really listen.
Mm-hmm. Great question. And congratulations on your new baby.
Daniel, what's our very next house call?
My ears get impacted very easily. Using Q-tips does not help keep them clear, and while I hate the plugged-up feeling in my ears and sometimes it makes my ears hurt, I don't have enough time to get to a walk-in clinic and get them taken care of. Is there anything you would recommend to clear my ears and help keep them clear before they get impacted?
Sure. And we've talked about a study on the show before. There are these over-the-counter ear wax drops that you can get at any pharmacy, CVS, grocery store that'll just say ear wax remover kit. No particular brand matters. But what it has in there are these little drops that you can put in your ears that will keep it soft. And that way, and usually it has like a bulb syringe or something where you could squirt water in there and help wash it out. You basically can do what you would get in the office. You can do it yourself at home, or you could have a loved one help you do it.
And you know what my grandmother used to recommend?
About Q-tips?
No. But they did say if you put that Q-tip in your ear, it's going to get stuck.
Only if you should
if
only
you flip
put
your eye
elbow.
Up, your eye is going to get stuck. There's always something was going to get stuck in there. Like, can you walk around with a Q-tip just hanging out? But we have pulled things out of ears that we don't even want to mention.
No.
But what she had recommended was the old folk remedy by putting one or two drops of olive oil mm-hmm. in the eardrums once or twice a month, and that can cut down on the accumulation of the wax. And I tell you, I've been recommending that because I don't think there's real harm in it. And patients tell me that they have much less wax production. So I'd like to see some studies of it, but I like it.
And also the Q-tips themselves, if you are a big wax producer, someone who makes a lot of wax in your ears, those Q-tips are part of what's packing it in. So use these over-the-counter remedies and try not to use the Q-tip so much. Okay, let's take our very last house call question. Daniel?
I recently had a routine checkup with my doctor. I told him that I have a glass of wine with dinner every night and then usually another with a friend or while watching TV. I'm a 35-year-old woman and am otherwise in good health, but my doctor suggested that I consider dialing it back a little. I didn't think I was drinking all that much, but since then I've been a little concerned. What do you think?
Well, I think it is worth paying attention to and dialing it back, because if you're having a glass of wine every day and then also another one later on, that's two a day, that's 14 a week. And a lot of people then might go out to dinner or something on the weekend and maybe have another one. And that ends up being what's considered for women in this category of risky drinking. It doesn't necessarily mean something bad directly will happen to you, but it is in this category of flirting with dangerous drinking.
Chris, you ever sometimes feel like we get put in the middle between the doctor and patients? You know, the doctor could be right and you could be right. Part of it is maybe the doctor asked you some questions like, have you ever had to cut down on the amount you drink? Mm-hmm. Do you ever get angry if someone says you drink too much? Do you ever feel guilty that you might drink too much? And you know, if you answer yes to any of those questions, the doctor may say, aha, you say it's one per night, but it's really probably more closer to two or three. Most people will underestimate rather than overestimate how much they drink when they're sitting in front of the doctor. So maybe you're right. Maybe the doctor's right.
Right.
I definitely think Christy's right.
Well, and that advice to, I mean, when you think about all the harms that can come from excessive drinking, legal problems, family dynamic problems, liver problems, whenever I see those, you know, the really harmful effects of heavy drinking, it's always a good reality check for me as a physician to bring that up with patients. It's the spirit of prevention that your doctor is trying to prevent this from becoming a problem for you than trying to, you know, be hard on you.
Yeah, I like that dial here that I can just see that dial up. It's at about six or seven. You probably would do better about two or three here. So I like that dialing it back a little bit. We're not saying stop, but dialing it back probably. If you think that may be a good idea, we're probably supportive. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, Christy. And we hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to our listeners. If they want to share questions and stories, they can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. Get our health app by searching one word, Your Health, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guests today, Dr. Scheitman and Dr. Steiner. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we'll talk to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.